Hi, everyone. I'm Gretchen. Hi, Gretchen. And I'm married to the guy who is just reading, and I have to tell you, the kind of Al-Anon I am, I was thinking about all of the rules he was kind of breaking, and that's just true about who I am. I'm so happy to see your faces. I'm so happy that you get to see my face. You know, it's really nice to be seen, and I have to tell you that the disease of alcoholism, I didn't always want to be seen. And that's probably true for you, too, at some point in your life. I really want to thank John, who asked me to speak tonight. Not my husband, John. Another John. Thank you. Thank you for asking me to be a part of my own recovery and to come and share my experience, strength, and hope. And like a friend, Nancy, says, I'm really honored to get to be a small piece of your big miracle. So with that, I have a little funny story. Whoever did the baskets, thank you. They're beautiful. And forgive my weird text. So here's the deal. These baskets, it was you. Okay. Yeah. I just need to clear this up really quickly. So here's the deal. There's these great lemon drops in there. My great-grandmother, who I'm named after, always had these lemon drops in the home that she lived in. After her stroke, everything, until the day she died. And so I texted and said, thank you so much for this beautiful basket. You know, my great-grandmother, who I'm named after, something, something, and I'm naked with her, is what it texted. And the response back was question mark, and I said, OMG, LOL, weird. My namesake, but it just typed naked, naked. So I'm not naked with my great-grandmother. That never happened in my story, okay? I have a lot of other weird stuff, but not that one. But thank you. Thank you. All right, so here's the deal. You know, welcome to anybody who's new. And to those of you who aren't new, welcome anyway. Again, it's great to be in person. It's great to get to hear a little something about recovery. If my story doesn't resonate with you, that's okay. There are so many wonderful speakers this weekend and great meetings that you're going to get to go to. What I love for you to do and invite you to do is to listen for the similarities and the feelings. The details are going to be different, not for all of you. Some of you, it'll feel the same, but just listen for the similarities in the way that you feel. I really feel honored when Ashley was singing Amazing Grace, I got teary-eyed. You know, your voice is beautiful, Ashley. And Amazing Grace, you know, who saved a wretch like me. I came in here because I wanted to blame a lot of people, places, and things for my behavior. And the truth is, I did grow up with the disease of alcoholism, and you're going to hear about that. But my behavior, I'm the wretch. And Amazing Grace, my higher power, saved a wretch like me. My own demoralizing acts got me into this program. My own obsession and thinking keep me in this program. And it's a blessing. It really is that we get to come and be a part of this worldwide fellowship. Look at these flags back here. That's just here in our region, but we are a worldwide fellowship. And what that means is we're never, ever alone. So I grew up in a family of alcoholism. My parents were very young when they married, under 20. My dad's so shiny, hip, slick, and cool. My mom was very beautiful. She still is very beautiful. She'll probably listen to this, so you know. And it's true, and it's true. So on the way over here, I took a selfie with my husband and I and sent it to my parents. They're divorced, but they're still very good friends. And I said, thanks for all the material. You know, they're in program a very long time. My dad always likes to say, go ahead and make things up if you need to. Dad, there's nothing I need to make up. We've got hours and hours worth of things that I can share. But you know, what I learned in this program is that the story's not about my mom or my dad. There's going to be things that you hear about them, but it's really about me and my reaction to the disease of alcoholism. So what happened for me is I grew up in a family and I kept a lot of secrets. I was embarrassed of the jail that my father would go to. I was embarrassed about the men that my mom would bring home. I was embarrassed about the fleas that we had at our house. Now, that might not have to do with alcoholism, but it might. I'm not sure. I was embarrassed a lot, and I didn't want people to know. I was embarrassed about the fights. I was embarrassed that the best friend that I had, and I only could have one friend at a time because I didn't know how to manage more than that, hostage. And so here's what happened there. I was really embarrassed and felt abandoned when that friend was no longer allowed to play with me because the police were at our house too much. And each of those embarrassments, each of those feelings led to secrets, which led to shame, which led to me not feeling good enough. And the deal is this, we all have secrets. And if you grew up with alcoholism, or you've clearly lived with alcoholism, or you wouldn't be here, you have secrets. There's things that you're ashamed of, and there's things that are stuck in your throat and in your chest, and there's things that make us sick. And it's all about us, and it's our reaction to the disease called alcoholism. And the good news is that even though we get as sick as the drinker, we get better. We get better, and you're all getting better just sitting in this seat. I'm getting better as I'm speaking. And that's the miracle of what we get promised. So my family, there were a lot of things that I learned in my family of origin, and they just are what they are, right? It's facts. It's not good. It's not bad. It's neutral. It's just what my plate was. Like I said, my parents were pretty hip, slick, and cool. My dad was in a band, and he was the first alcoholic that I chased. You know, a story goes that I was very, very little. We lived in this cute little house, and he went across the street to the liquor store, and I crawled after him, and like on a very busy street. So I've been chasing alcoholics a long time. And I love my dad, and my dad loves me, and I love my mom, and my mom loves me. But, you know, the parties that they had, they'd put me in a drawer up high and whatever, and then the parties that they had, I'd go and drink the rest of what was in the cups and throw up and those sorts of things. And that's just some of it, you know, that's the mild stuff that happened. My parents had my brother, and I was kind of like his mom for a really long time. It's even weird, sometimes I still feel like his mom. One of my sons is so much like him, and it was while he was growing up, I was like, wow, I'm raising my brother again. And that arrogant, smug, self-righteous, where my ladies at, where you guys at, like that was me, right? Arrogant, smug, self-righteous, because that was the way, there was no other choice of how I was going to be in order to survive the surroundings. We had police activity often, like police came to our house. My mom and dad split up when I was little, you know, 7 or so. And my mom was young when they split up. So she, rightfully so, had a lot of different men in her life. And sometimes they'd live with us. One of them during a breakup, he was a nice enough guy, but he came back and my mom was across the street with a neighbor, and every other Thursday we'd have dinner together. What it really meant was that they got to drink and smoke weed. And so it was her night, it was our night at the neighbor's house, but my brother and I had already come home to go to sleep. And that boyfriend who had moved out came over, and he's like lurking in my room. Now this guy never tried anything. I don't have any of like sexual assault stuff in my story, but he lurked in my room, and I can remember that feeling of being scared. And there was another secret, because I didn't have the right words for what was happening. And I felt as if I'd had some kind of molestation done. So I was really confused, because that's not what happened. But what was he doing in my room? Like, what are you doing, buddy? And if I saw, like, what were you doing, buddy? He left, and I called my dad. And the crazy thing is, my dad actually had a phone. We were the payphone people. You'd call the payphone, people would come and get us, you know. But he actually had a landline, and he came over. And when he came over, he was wearing his steel-toed boots, and he had a hatchet. And I don't know about you, but I love a man with a hatchet. I really love a man with a hatchet, a knife, a weapon, fists, big muscles. Like, I love all of those violent things. And the reason why is that in that moment, violence and love got really confused for me. Violence equaled love in some way, because our wires get tripped in alcoholism. The stories aren't true. Violence does not equal love, but we were a pack and you couldn't touch us. I don't know what my dad was going to do with that hatchet. The boyfriend was gone, so good. But the police came over, because people can't go walking around with hatchets. So the police were called, probably by the best friend's mom, who knows. And, you know, they said to me, "You're the only adult in the house. Why don't you put your parents to bed?" You know, and I'm glad they didn't take me to Child Protective Service or whatever happens there. But at the same time, that's a big burden. That's too much responsibility. And in these rooms, I've done a lot of work on that younger self. That's not something that should have happened. It just isn't. You know, the guy in my bedroom, that's not something that should have happened, no matter what his intentions were. So what happened for me, that was another secret. There was a man in my bedroom. My dad came over with a hatchet. My mom was intoxicated and couldn't help me in that moment. And my little brother, you know, was a little, and I was helpless. I was powerless for one of many, many times in my life. But for me, powerlessness, I always made myself bigger and stronger. And I'm small, but don't mess with me. And that was the persona that I really developed. And that was also a secret that underneath, I was so vulnerable and so scared all the time. I was so scared of losing love for my parents, so scared that I didn't mean anything, because why were they drinking so much? What the heck? So scared that I wasn't enough in the world. You know, so I'm an overachiever. That's just what it causes. And we come in here and we become anything. You know, alcoholism does a different number to all of us. And what I know is that with that fear and with those secrets and with the stories, I created an identity. You know, we create this false identity. At least I created a false identity about who I was. I was tough. You're not going to mess with me. I'm better than you. You know, because I didn't want anyone to know anything that was happening in my house. That's why I only had one friend at a time. I could kind of manage and tap dance that friend, or they could feel really bad for me, but I didn't really like that much. I tried that out. I didn't do victim very well. So I just was always super powerful. That's a false identity. I'm not that powerful. I wanted love. I wanted hugs. I wanted attention. And the trick is, we did have love and hugs and attention and fun. It was just always really weirdly ramped up. Just really weirdly ramped up, you know, too big, too many feelings. And that emotional charge is a lot to understand. It's a lot to feel. It's a lot that really courses through you. And so I didn't know what to do with that. I didn't know what to do with those feelings. And so the secrets, just secret after secret after secret. Something else that I was thinking about, you know, because the talk is the talk, right? My story is just my story, and it's always this story because I lived it. It's interesting because I got into relationships that felt very important. And I can remember my first very serious relationship. Very serious. I was in eighth grade, and it was very serious. And when that guy and I didn't work out, we were in eighth grade. When it didn't work out, it was a serious devastation. Another secret, I'm not good enough. When the boyfriend that, you know, we got together freshman year and stayed together through senior year, we had violence in our relationship, and that was a secret. And I decided that I was violent because I wasn't the one that you kicked around. You kick me, I'm going to kick you back, maybe in your teeth. That was a secret. You know, that was a secret. But here's the deal. My secrets were seeping out. I couldn't hide all of the secrets. People knew things but didn't say things. And so I look back and I was just very unprotected. People knew what was going on and nobody helped. Nobody helped. And so the other identity was, well, then you have to take care of yourself. And I really believe that. I have to take care of myself. No one else is standing up. I have to take care of myself. So I became very independent. That's problematic in many ways. I was for a long time a very suspicious person. If I lean into that old idea of who I am, I can still be very suspicious today that, we'll see. And that's not how I want to be. That's not who my higher power has made me to be. But with all the secrets and the shame and the story and that you're not good enough and your dad goes to jail and your mom has men over and we had chickens that ran around in our front yard and we lived in, you know, a regular neighborhood and my stepmother, who was 9 months, would run after the chickens and yell at people, "I'm going to kick your ass." So we had that too. The other thing is, we had the SWAT team at our house on the first day of ninth grade. Everyone had to walk the route to high school in front of my house, or it seemed that way, but I really think they all did have to walk that way. SWAT team is at my house. There are no friends that you're going to have. Even if I could have managed having more than one, that's not a thing. That is not a thing. That is just, so it wasn't. And here's the craziest part about that. The SWAT team was at my house for a crime my father did not commit. Someone had actually stolen his car to, like, rob a bank. But, you know, they came to his house because he was always in jail. So it made sense that they would show up there. So this is just the background. And what I know is that every choice I've ever made was the only choice that felt like it was in front of me at the time. To see that there were other choices, I would have had no clue. If someone would have said to me, Gretchen, you don't have to stay with a guy who roughs you up, that wouldn't have computed. If someone would have said, oh, sweetie, violence doesn't equal love, you know, that must have been really scary. That's all I wanted. That must have been really scary. No one said that to me. No one said that to me. So the identity, the secrets, the shame, it's just all there. And I have a lot of siblings. I have that one sweet little brother that my parents had, and then my dad had some other kids, and then I have a stepbrother on one side, another stepbrother on the other side, but they're all just my family. But this one particular brother, God, I love that guy. You know, grew up in the same house, but affected us differently, really affected us differently, although he has the violent streak too. So it's interesting. I think about how young I was and how bad I felt when I left for college, because I knew I was abandoning him. I really knew I was leaving him in the lion's den. My mother was newly sober. She got sober when I was like 16, 17. She's been sober a really long time, and I'm grateful for that. But, you know, I knew I was leaving him, and I'd been the parent. That's hard to give up, but it was never mine to carry. And I knew it hurt him. But I still needed to go because I really knew I needed to save myself. My mom also pushed me to go. She knew I needed to go to save myself. And so, you know, that brother and I, we've had quite the walk together. And it's a beautiful walk, and it's been a sad walk. It's been all the things, right? Because we get all of the emotions and alcoholism. But I left for college, and I left that, well, the eighth grade boyfriend I left, but then the other very serious boyfriend who roughed me up, who I roughed up back, was gone, and came to college, and you know, that was my first geographic. I didn't know about a geographic, but it was the first geographic. But there, nobody knew my secrets. No one knew my dad had been in jail. No one knew that some of my clothes had come from the dumpster. Nobody knew about the SWAT team. Nobody knew. No one knew I had been roughed up, that I roughed other people up. Like, nobody knew. And so I did my first like reinvention, except I wasn't very good at it because of all the shame and the false identity and the fear of being known. So came to college, had more very serious relationships, blah, 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 it's boring. But that's the way it went, right? Like that's the way that it went. And the whole time what I was trying to do was find the person, place, or thing, the right combination of feeling to make me feel good enough. And it didn't matter what it was. It could be shopping, it could be a boyfriend, it could be, I mean, really, it could be how many guys looked at me, it could be how much I weighed, it could be, you know, I mean, really anything I can remember. I can remember this from college, and wow, there was never the right combination. Never the right combination. Sometimes I could ride the teeter-totter and it would just be even, and that would be okay for a minute, and then it would be too even, and I'd have to sabotage it because it was just too even, and I didn't know about even. So I dated some nice guys. Poor guys. I did date them. A couple wanted to marry me, and that's disaster. I was really mean to them. Really, really mean to them. I did not know what to do to someone that was nice, and I was living under that false identity that I was mean and independent and didn't need anybody and not vulnerable, and you're an idiot. You know, I really, really have that you're an idiot thing. You're an idiot. And so that is not a nice way to be with people in a relationship, but I felt it, and I felt it a lot. And so here's the thing that ended up happening. I found myself at one point engaged to, I orchestrated and got engaged to this very shiny alcoholic who was not right for me in any way, even if you took away his alcoholism. We could not have been more mismatched. We just couldn't have been, but it didn't matter because he wanted to marry me, and that made me feel belong, like I belong, wanted, loved, and those sorts of things. So we go to Italy. He proposes maybe the second day that we're there. I really like trips. I had paid for the trip on my own. We still had 2 weeks. I like to have a good time, and I'm very intelligent and smart. If I said no, even though I knew it was a no, the trip would be ruined, and it was expensive. And so I said yes because I'm logical. And we planned a wedding. We planned that wedding. I remember my mom saying to me, you know, sweetie, you don't have to marry him. And I was like, what are you even, are you trying to give me dating advice? Like, what? Who are you? Don't talk to me about this. She was right, though. I didn't have to date him. So here's what happened. First of all, he was very emotionally unstable. But that seemed fine because violence equals love. So he liked to get kind of violent. And I was like, yeah, all right. And I remember one night he threw a bookcase over and asked me, do you want me to break your kneecaps now or later? And I said, well, do you want my dad to come over and shoot you now or later? My dad lived 400 miles away, but I had no doubt, because violence equaled love, that he would show up and shoot this MF if I needed him to. Like, I was positive that that could happen. Sorry, Dad, but that is what I thought. And, you know, I didn't marry him, thank God, but here's all of the things that happened. I managed, I manipulated, he lost jobs, I overworked to pay for things that needed to be paid for. I called in to his places of employment to make up lies and excuses. I remember his boss finally saying to me, Gretchen, I think that so-and-so has a problem with alcohol. And I was like, you don't know anything. But he did know. You know, he did know. He's in program, and he did know. I didn't know he was in program. I didn't know what a program. I mean, I knew my mom was doing something, but I didn't care about that. I didn't want any of her solutions to anything. I was so uninterested. She actually says, do you remember your first Al-Anon meeting? I'm like, yeah, Monday night in Encino. She's like, no. I took you. We were here. You wouldn't talk to people. You, like, were slithering around outside. I'm like, that didn't happen. It probably did. I don't know. I didn't care about it at all. Super shut down. But with this guy, one day I was going through his stuff. I like to pretend to say things because I used to lie a lot that I was doing his laundry and putting it away. I never put that guy's laundry away. Put your own laundry away. And I found all of these vodka bottles lining his drawer. And I laid them all out, had them all sitting up by the time he got home, and very indignantly said, what is this? And he said, baby, I'm just going to build ships in a bottle. I was like, okay. Because he was artistic. You know, so we believe the lies, we believe the stupid stuff, and we keep the secret. And I really went down the scale with him. I had so many things that I did that I am embarrassed about, not anymore because I've worked the steps, but that I was really embarrassed about and ashamed of, because it was such a lower version of who I am. And I don't know if you've ever found yourself in that place of being the lower version of who you are, and the things that you've done, and then the voice that tells you how bad you are because of it. I didn't know that there was another way, another thing to do, so I went and got my ex-boyfriend involved because that seemed like a very good idea. You know, and so that's the kind of crazy that I was. And then I was working for this company and I had to collect the rent. And he calls, I had to call him, my husband who's over here, and say, hey, Mr. H, pay rent or quit. And he was like, pay rent or quit? What? Okay, I'll pay the rent. And we talked for 2 hours. And so then he and I are kind of having, you know, a thing, and I've got this guy. And then I called him when I was engaged. He is in a profession in entertainment. I said, hey, can you do this thing for my wedding? And he said, wait, what? You're getting married? Are you getting married to that guy that doesn't talk? I'm like, well, which one? No, not that one. Getting married to this one. I was the runaway bride. People in my family would call me that, because that was the thing, is that, does my umbilical fit here? Does the right amount of person, places, and things get me the emotional charge that I need, just the right amount? And I couldn't walk that just the right amount. So alcoholics need alcohol. I just need feelings. I don't need anything. The feelings are more than enough. I don't know what would happen if I drank. I just didn't do that because I was so scared of it from, you know, from my family. And I can't pretend I never drank, because I did in college. And so he and I get involved. And then suddenly I'm not getting married to the alcoholic, but I'm going to marry him instead. And it's worked out. It's worked out. But, you know, it's 22 years. But, man, it was crazy. It was, wow. So now we'll get to that. So here's the deal. We've been married 22 years. I've been in program 21 and a half. Okay, so there we go. And it's necessary. We went to a marriage counselor. Maybe I went alone first. I don't know how it happened. And she said, you need to go to a place called Al-Anon and never leave. Don't come back. Like, basically, don't come back to her, you know, because I would call and cry and whatever else. And she was like, you need to go to a place called Al-Anon and never come back. I was like, what the hell? My mom keeps saying that, too. What? Why? So I went and I showed up to an Al-Anon meeting. Encino Monday Night, How an Al-Anon Will Grow. I showed up in black, slithering in the back, probably like I did the first time that I don't remember. And someone in the parking lot like said something to me and I thought I was gonna knock her out. You know, she said something and it was probably even nice, but I was like ready to have a fist fight. And she was like, "Hey, the meeting's upstairs." And I was like, "Yeah, all right." So stupid, but it's hilarious. So I go upstairs and I don't know what happened that first night. It's like a blackout, something. I came back the next week and then I came back another week and Betty Ann was speaking. And if she wouldn't have been speaking on this night, I wouldn't have stayed because I had tried it, I think the year before, to get a boyfriend back, and I went immediately to the ninth step on my own to make amends to him. And that didn't work out very well. So poor guy. And then I wanted to make another amends to him when I was really in program, and my sponsor said, "Never call him again. That is your amend. Like, you just stop contacting him." Oh my God, that's so funny too. Okay, so Betty Ann was speaking, and she has this story. I probably have part of it wrong, but it was something about Bob, and he came home drunk one more time, and Betty Ann's waiting in her like lingerie with a cigarette or something, and he came home, and she flicks it at him in the leaves. At least that's the way I heard it, and in my mind, she tried to burn him up. True or false, it made me stay in program, because I was that kind of crazy. I was like, all right, okay, I need to know what this woman has to say. Never called her. That was enough. I need to know what she had to say, but not enough to do anything about it. But I kept coming back to the meetings because I was hearing something in there, hearing something, and some of those secrets were starting to like spill out of my mouth. Someone would say, "How are you?" And I'd suddenly like say something that didn't make me look good. That wasn't a part of the looking good identity. Even though my looking good identity was violent, it wasn't a part of that. It was like getting a little softer, and then I'd freak out about that. I was feral. That's the truth. I was like feral coming in. And I stayed in program, and I got a sponsor, and I'd go to these parties and set up a chair and wash dishes. I was really mad about having to wash your dishes. Like, is your arm broken? Why do I have to wash your dishes? I didn't want to make coffee. I didn't want to set up a chair. Like, I was that sort. And I did it. I did it anyway. And things slowly got better. And then there was a day at a church, a really big church, where he and I, we were already married. And we always sat in this one section of the church, but I had broken my foot. And so it wasn't easy for me to get up the stairs. And you know what? That's a lie. It was easy for me to get up the stairs. I was socially awkward. I didn't like humans. I felt uncomfortable in this church, this rich church where I still felt like the poor abandoned girl. He's so gregarious, as you could see. And I felt very unfriendly, unlikable, and go up and talk to people about what I don't even like those people. They're like my fake church friends. So that's the truth. I could, you know what? That's the first time I've said that. I could have gotten up those stairs. I can do anything. I could have gotten up the stairs. I didn't want to, and it was a good excuse. But when he left, the trigger of abandonment, the trigger of not feeling good enough, the trigger of feeling like that 7-year-old girl whose dad was in jail, whose clothes were from the dumpster, who the police came over, whose best friend I couldn't play with anymore, I was standing there and I was her, 7 years old. He came back down, I wasn't 7 anymore. I was ready to fight, and I did. Tried to hit him with my crutch. I couldn't get up the stairs, right? But I could hit you with my crutch and then chase you, running, with a key that I tried to stab him with in the neck. But I couldn't get up the stairs? Bullshit. Okay, so I was in program for 6 months when that happened, and that was my big, big, ugly secret. And it solidified every bad thing I ever thought about myself, and my identity in that story got bigger. You know, the way that I look at it is that secrets have a 1-2-3 punch, and the first part of that is the one is the action that you took. So the stabbing, it wasn't much of a secret, but I wanted to keep that a secret. It's a huge church. It was, like, a lot of people saw it, but no one came to help. They were probably afraid of me. The two is the identity, you know, that story that we carry around, and it really kept me from having friends. It kept me from being vulnerable. It kept me from better jobs. I'd fight every boss that I have because they'd say I was insubordinate, and I was like, what does that even mean? What do you mean? What, you're not even smart, idiot. Because idiot was my favorite thing to say, and I thought I could do their job better, which I think I could have. That's actually true. But I didn't work well with others. And it kept me in that. And then the third part is the reason we created in the first place. And if I were to play the screen of my life, the show of my life back here, and you've heard it, Of course I was violent. What other choice did I have? I didn't know that violence wasn't okay. It equaled love. I didn't know that I could have just sat there and calmly done some breathing techniques. Breathing techniques? What? Come on, man. There's no breathing technique in that moment. I didn't know, but I also didn't have the choice because I hadn't learned it yet. And so when I, first a friend told me violence was never okay, I never spoke to her again. Because I was like, who are you? If you've seen what I've seen, you know, violence is okay and it's necessary. So yeah, we stopped being friends. But I talked to my sponsor, and it's great that your sponsor might be your friend, but is more your sponsor. And my sponsor did not want to be my friend when I was 6 months in program. And what I'm describing, I'm so glad they even like picked up the phone like, hi, Gretchen. You know, I'm sure of it because I sponsor women. I know how that goes. And they would tell me what to do, and I would do it. I have walked so many miles at a park by my house because I have to get it out physically, the violence. And I mean, the grooves in those shoes, I went through so many pairs of tennis shoes from all the exercising. But here's the deal. I worked all the steps, and I got a little bit better. And then I worked the steps again, and I got a little better. I worked the steps again. When I first came here, I thought this was a remedial program. Why were you here for 40 years? What is wrong with you, idiot? I mean, really, like, and you're all happy that you've been here 40 years? And I was like, wow, okay, weird. I'll be gone in 12 weeks. I'm gonna have this mastered. Thank God that's not how it went. And thank God you loved me anyway. And thank God for step two. In the step work, I've noticed a lot. People like to rush to get to that fourth and fifth step. They feel like that's the big, big step. Step two is the magic. We get to be restored to sanity. Restored, made whole, back to our default, before the secrets, before the shame. Restored by a higher power who's bigger than me, who has better thoughts than me. Restored and able to see that when I'm connected to a higher power of my understanding, I'm really able to see myself differently. You know, my higher power shows me my insides and the mirror shows me my outsides. But I didn't know that. But higher power shows me who I am. So the restored to sanity, I didn't really know that I didn't have sanity, but as I really worked this step and worked it one at a time and didn't rush through it just to get to the fourth, life slowed down. I slowed down. I was able to be more mature. I was able to be more graceful. I was able to be friendly. I was able to have friends. And when I think about that part of the restoring too, you know, the deal is this: whoever wrecked me, whatever wrecked me, whoever wrecked you, whatever wrecked you, whatever wreckage you've caused, restored. We're restored. It's okay. That identity that I'd created that was never, ever true, it was never the way that God saw me, it got to fall away. I didn't have to be mean. And I can remember working step work with my sponsor and saying, but if I'm not mean, does it mean I'm nice? Because I don't want to be nice. Nice is weak. She was so funny. She's like, well, you might not ever really be nice, but that's so funny now that I think about that. I am nice now. But the mean part, you know, I was still so scared, and I had to work on that with the scared, but I couldn't do it on my own. It's a partnership with the steps. I have to show up, and my higher power shows up. And the more that I show up and work the steps, the more my higher power can reveal to me about who I am. And that's really important in this. So, you know, that brother that I was talking about, there was a time once where he was in the park, and he hasn't always been someone that has a home. He's sometimes been without a house and has been on the streets. And there was a time that my dad and I went and we found him, and I said, hey, how you doing? And he threw a beer in my face. And I remember feeling so small and so assaulted and so little, because it was just part of that story, part of the lens. Everything has to support the identity once you create it. So I'm always looking then for evidence to create my lack story. And it's funny because it happened during step work, during my ninth step. And I had, you know, there's a lot of emotions and memories that are gone for me. And maybe for you too, depending on, you know, whatever violence has happened for you or whatever alcoholic thing has happened for you. And that week, I remembered that in college, that nice boyfriend that I had, I'd been nominated Rose Princess. Very big honor, and coming from where I came from, I never thought I'd get to be that, with the crown on my head and whatever else. And he said something to me because I was flirting with another guy, and I think he probably said, don't flirt with that guy, and I was very offended by being told what to do. And I threw a beer in his face, but I had forgotten that. So that beer that my brother threw in my face, I walked around like a victim for so long on that. He was violent with me, and he did this, and he did that. My brother was using. I was sober. I hadn't had a drink. We had the exact same symptoms, the exact same ways that we acted out, and I couldn't remember. My guess is my brother doesn't remember either that that happened, but our memories start resurfacing as we come to program and as we work these steps. So the beauty of all of this and the magic of program is that we get to step into the masterpiece of who we really are. If I would have lived in that lower version of myself, of believing that I was nothing and believing that I didn't matter, I really would have missed out on my great big life. There's so many opportunities that I never would have taken. And the truth is, when I work with women today that I sponsor, I tell them, the world needs you. The world needs you to work these steps. The world needs you to uncover your gift, the gift of your higher power, because if you don't, you're ripping everyone off, not just yourself. We're all meant to do something, but until higher power tells us what that is, and the more we get revealed, and the more the old identity goes away, and those secrets are gone, and the shame leaves, we can't see it. We do adjacent living. And I lived in adjacent living for a really long time. And it can be scary to step into the light, but as you do step into light, you're not doing it alone. And in these steps and in these rooms, we're never by ourselves. I was nervous tonight. You know, I speak all the time. It's not really that hard for me, but this felt very important because we haven't been together in this way in a really long time. And a lot of you have heard my story, and I thought, it's my story. I get bored of hearing my story. And so I really went to my higher power and asked, what is it? What's the difference this time? And that's what he put on my heart, was that thing about restored. And it's important for us all to hear it, I think. And you know, for the one person who it's great for, great, come hug me after. And if it isn't, that's okay too. You know, it's all right. How much longer do I have, Nick? Okay, great. All right. First he told me I had to talk for an hour and a half. I was like, oh, come on, man. That's boring. No one wants to carry the message, just to be clear. I didn't want to carry the message for all of you for that long. No one wants to listen for someone for an hour and a half. I mean, I made you laugh, but zip it. Let's get it going. I'm just teasing you. Thank you. Okay, so here, you know, we have these beautiful boys. They're really men now. It's so funny. I was thinking about this at dinner with Corinne and Shamu, that Corinne gave me a baby shower in our home when we didn't have furniture yet. And it was like our first home buying it together. Well, it's the only home we've bought together, but it was just so beautiful and so sweet and so empty. And she brought this crib and everyone filled it up with presents. And you know, we don't do things by ourselves. And those boys now, they're 15 and 17. One's getting ready to go to college. The other one, he's performing tonight. I'm missing that. I'll see him tomorrow doing it. And he and I were texting each other. I told him, hey, good luck with your thing. He's like, Mom, and good luck with yours. You're gonna bless so many people, and prayed me up. And it's beautiful because we have something different than what I had growing up. You know, it's the same foundation of love, because what I know is that my parents loved me. They love me still. It's amazing, our relationship. You know, my dad and I were just a month apart in program. My mom has like 40 years. But for my kids to have never seen me the way I was before I got to program is a miracle. And it's not that I never messed up. It's not that they don't know my story. It's not that I've never flipped out, because I have. But they really get to have a good mom who's awake and who's there with them and has the right amount of emotion. I'm not trying to find that too high, too low emotion anymore to fill myself up with people, places, and things and the right amount of energy. You know, it's God. It's God, and that's it. Nothing else is going to fill me up. Not my, you know, not the way that my relationship is, not friendship, not my job. It always has to get turned back to God. I lost a really important person in my life last year, my grandma. My grandma was my angel. Yeah, my grandparents, they moved to the town that we live in because of everything with my parents, and they knew that me and my brother needed a place. And we'd be there on weekends, like every single weekend, and my grandma was everything wonderful. And she's one of the only people that I ever felt loved me no matter what, loved me unconditionally, and we all get a person like that in our life. And so losing her was huge. I have a reminder in my phone that says call Grammy, and it comes up every Tuesday at 12 o'clock. And I haven't taken it out of my phone because I get to remember to call Grammy. You know, I call Grammy, and there was one night not too long ago that I just really missed her. And I said, God, I miss Grammy. I wish I could see her. And she and I would always talk about our dreams that we had. And she'd say, well, this happened in my dream. What do you think it means? And I'd tell her what happened in mine, and we'd analyze. That night when I went to sleep, I had this beautiful dream, and she didn't have her walker, and she didn't have her breathing machine, and we were walking the houses in the housing development, looking at the kitchens. She was a great cook, and she taught Hungarian cooking. And she'd always tell me what she was going to do with the kitchens, and it was a long dream, not like one of those short ones where you're like, oh, I want more. And I woke up, and I just said, thank you, God. Thank you, higher power, because I got to spend a day with her. And you know, when I look back, that part about the identity that I really was so sure of, that I was alone, that I didn't count, that I was abandoned, that I wasn't good enough, that I wasn't pretty, that I didn't matter, it was never, ever true. Had I not come to this program and let you, I was the one you loved in a very special way, and let you love me in a very special way, you know, and I didn't love you at all, and let you love me in a very special way, I wouldn't be able to bring this message to you. Program works. I'm a tough case. He saved a wretch like me. That story, that old identity, it's not true for me, and it's not true for you. And so get with your higher power. Work with your sponsor. Think about being restored to your default settings before all the stuff happened, before you were afraid, before you felt that story being you, because it's not true. You're so much more than that, and the world needs a little bit of who you are. Thank you, everyone.